Okay, well, good morning, brethren, and good morning to those of you who may be tuning in on the internet. Glad of your company. We're now beginning our second week of studying the first letter of the Apostle Peter. So if you'd like to find that in your New Testament. And just as a quick reminder of what we said last week, in chapter 1 of 1 Peter, if we just reread verses 3 and 4, we remember that Peter said, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope. Verse 4, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. So Peter was making it very plain, as far as he could, that we were looking to a fabulous future in the world tomorrow. Something that's incorruptible, cannot be defiled, a tremendous inheritance. And it becomes particularly relevant in a sense as we read through Peter that Peter was emphasizing the glorious future in part because the people he was writing to, like you and me today, were going through some difficulties. There were some disappointments, some challenges, quite a bit of persecution, it seems. And at times, there were some sufferings that just made it a wee bit difficult to carry on. And Peter knew that. He wanted to, therefore, build up in their minds this tremendous vision of the future that God has for us, this tremendous living hope, this confident expectation of a glorious future. And we see that dropping down to verse 6. In this, he says, this tremendous salvation that lies ahead, you greatly rejoice. Though now, in this present time, here and now, for a little while if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. And I think all of us can probably say, yep, there are some times in our life when the wind is behind us, and sometimes it's in our face, and it's hard work making progress. Peter knew that, God knows that. But of course, you know, God has a way and means of bringing us forward. So moving on to chapter 2, this is where we got to last week, dropping down to chapter 2 and verses 4 and 5, we see here that we are to come to Jesus Christ as to a living stone, but notice, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. So Jesus Christ, who is our example, as we'll see later, was rejected. The world did not accept Jesus Christ. The religious leaders of Jesus' day did not receive him, that's for sure. They ended up nailing him to a tree. So therefore, says Peter, writing to the brethren who were suffering somewhat, meeting difficulties in their lives, and perhaps occasionally wondering whether it was all worthwhile, he says, Jesus was rejected. He was the chief cornerstone, precious in God's sight, precious in our sight, but he was rejected. So therefore, in a sense, don't be too surprised if you meet troubles and difficulties and you find yourselves rejected. But verse 9 says, Peter, remember, you are a chosen generation. You are a royal priesthood. As we saw last week, being priests means that every last one of us has access to God's Holy of Holies. So we are a very special people, even though the world does not recognize us, and even though the world at times absolutely opposes us. And of course, the days will come when, you know, persecution reappears against the Church of God, against true Christians, in perhaps just a few years' time. And it seems that perhaps in Peter's day, there was quite a bit of that taking place. Okay, well, that was just a quick resume of last week. Fabulous future, but some difficulties here and now at the moment. Moving on then to let's pick it up in verse 17, which is where we finished last week. Peter was writing, honor all people. You know, we should be a body of people who are respectful of others, whether they would be slaves, like in Peter's day. We should still respect people. They're human beings. They're made in the image and likeness of God. They have the potential to be born into God's family as our brothers and sisters forevermore, so we should respect them. They may be ignorant today of God's purposes, but let's be fair, once upon a time so were you and I. And very often we could realize that there, but for the grace of God, literally, would go you and I. So let's honor all people, especially love the brethren or the brotherhood, and whilst we respect our neighbors and our workmates and so on, for the brethren, it should be somewhat higher than that. Fear God, respect or honor the King. Then moving on to verse 18, this is starting again this week. Verse 18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear or respect, not only to the good and the gentle, but also to the harsh. So Peter's beginning to give some rather practical advice to us all. We see here, verse 18, it says, servants. When we get to chapter 3, 1, it says, likewise, you wives. Chapter 3, verse 7 says, likewise, you husbands. And verse 8 says, finally, all of you. So Peter's going to take it sort of, if you like, section by section. First of all, the household servants, today perhaps we could say employees, but certainly those who are in a service position, it says, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, or being respectful, being courteous, not only to the good and the gentle, but even to the ones who aren't so pleasant. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, many of us have worked, I'm sure, for bosses of all sorts. And perhaps if we've been around the block a few times, we've had good bosses who were decent and, you know, respectful and courteous and would ask us to do something, please. And it's quite easy, in a sense, to cooperate with bosses like that. There are other bosses who, of course, have a very different approach. They're in charge, and boy, you better realize that. When I shout, you just jump, how high, sir? And I've had bosses of both sorts. Thankfully, in most of my working career, I've had very reasonable managers and bosses who've been quite decent, very respectful, and have always invited my opinions and listened to them and so on. But once or twice I've had some of the other sort, and they can be quite difficult and make your life extremely difficult. Well, says Peter, doesn't matter which way they are, you need to be submissive, do your very best as far as you humanly can to cooperate with them. Verse 19, for this is commendable if, because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? I mean, frankly, if we've let down in the job, done some rather poor work, and so on, and we get berated for it, criticized for it, perhaps we lose some money because of it, well, there's no great credit in that, is there? But when you do good, says Peter, and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And the attitude here really is an attitude not of lying down and being rolled over by other people, but endeavoring as far as you can to be peaceful, to be patient, to be cooperative, to seek to go above and beyond the call of duty, to be, if you like, a top class, first class employee or servant. You may occasionally step out of line and do something wrong, in which case, fair enough, if you're criticized for that, take it manfully. But you may at times, in this imperfect world, be criticized and condemned even for doing good. And you think, well, this is just not fair. I mean, I've done my very best. You know, I've sweated for this company, and I've really put myself out, and I've sacrificed, and look, I'm being condemned and jumped upon from a great height. This is not, no, I'm not having this. And you're about to bristle and start attacking back, and blood flying and fur flying and so on. Well, says Peter, no, no, no. If you are being jumped upon when you're in the right, okay, you may have to do some things about that to be just, you know, to ensure that you handle it in an appropriate manner. But don't start reacting. don't say, well, if they're going to come against me with a sledgehammer, we're going to go against them with our huge exocet or an atom bomb, and by the time we're finished, there's blood everywhere and the company's imploded. No, that's not the intention. The intention is, okay, do what's appropriate or necessary, but do it in a commendable manner. Do it respectfully. But by and large, as far as you can, just quietly, patiently put up with it. Verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. So Peter says, you know, essentially, when you find that you've been criticized, condemned for doing good, let me just remind you, says Peter, that Jesus Christ, our example, had exactly the same experience. And we've been called, really, to follow his steps. So no great surprise if what happened to Jesus will happen to you as well. Verse 22, talking of Jesus, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth. Remember, Jesus was frequently criticized by the Jewish leaders and the rabbis and so on. They called him a blasphemer. They called him a drunk. They called him a party animal. They called him a few other things as well. But did Jesus react? Did he sort of say, oh, how dare they? Let me sort them out. I'll put a few plagues in their houses tonight. No, Jesus did not allow, if you like, his conscience, his calmness of mind to be bothered or agitated by other people. He knew what was right. He knew what was good and proper. And you couldn't move Jesus from that. His standards were so high, and he held to them, that you could not push Jesus around. He knew what God's will was, he knew what was right, and he would do it. And the sense is that you and I should be of a similar mind as Jesus. If we know what is right and proper, don't start reacting carnally, don't start getting angry, hostile, bitter, twisted, even if you're being unjustly and unfairly accused, because you don't want your mind to become twisted. Rise above it and just recognize that in this very imperfect world, where Satan is the god of this age, that sometimes, even for doing good, you will be criticized. Moving down to verse 23, still talking of Jesus, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. You know, he just counted to 10 and then stopped. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. So Jesus, in a sense, knew that the vengeance, if you like, belongs to God. It wasn't for Jesus to start getting all angry and thinking, well, I've got tremendous power, I can call them legions of angels, by the time I'm finished here, there'll just be a great big smoking hole in the ground. That would hardly have advanced, you know, God's purpose and plan. And for you and I, the same, you know, basic attitude should be there, that we don't always seek to react in a carnal manner. Whoa, wait till I give them a piece of my mind. Well, no, they don't want a piece of your mind. If you're being reviled, it might be best many, many occasions to just quietly think, well, they don't know the whole story. They've only got part of the picture. They're in Satan's world. They're but for the grace of God, frankly, go I. In their place, I've done the same thing, so let me not get too agitated and hostile. If I've got to suffer sometimes for doing what is good, well, so be it. I can live with that because Jesus has trodden that path before me. I know that one of the places I worked a few years ago, when they found out that I kept the Sabbath, and wouldn't come to their orgies, but it wasn't far off that, they didn't like it. And thereafter, they took considerable pleasure in making my life very difficult because they wanted a team player, which meant in their case, somebody who would go out on the Sabbath, somebody who would go to places of ill repute and participate with them in their activities. And because they paid my salary, of course, and could tell me what to do in the office, they took, you know, some mischief in trying to make life as uncomfortable for me as they could. But what should you do? You know, react, get bitter and twisted, or just endeavor to do the best you can and not be, if you like, twisted by their approach. That's obviously the better way. That particular man at the moment is facing a jail sentence because the company that he ran went into liquidation due to dishonesty and fraud at a very high level. So I guess things all work out in the long term. So just looking at verse 22, by the way, it says, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, and obviously neither should it be found in ours. That scripture there is actually quoted from Isaiah 53, verse 9. And I'll just mention that because we'll find that there's three references in the next few moments to Isaiah chapter 53, and we will turn there. So just keep it in the back of your mind that who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, belongs to Isaiah 53 as part of the description of Jesus Christ, our Messiah, our Passover Lamb. Moving down then to verse 24, and we're talking still about the fact that Jesus was willing to suffer all sorts of things for our good. He left us an example that he did not turn on those who accused him. He did not seek to get even with them. He took suffering. He took their criticisms. He took their abuse and so on. And he took it even farther. Verse 24, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, and the word is tree there, not cross or anything like that, who bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. So Jesus, if you like, took the suffering, frankly, as far as a human being could do. He not only took, if you like, verbal abuse, he not only took, you know, being ignored, being humiliated, but he was actually willing to be striped, as it mentions there, to be scourged with this you know, horrible instrument with all these whips and thongs and bits of, you know, bone and metal and stone to tear his flesh apart, and take that physical suffering even upon himself without retaliating, because he didn't, did he? You've read the Gospels. At no time did Jesus call for the angels to defend him. At no time did he sort of issue any condemnation or curses upon them. Right there, hanging on the tree, he said, you know, Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing. And Jesus was willing to take the totally unfair, unjust, illegal, horrible, twisted, perverted punishment and suffering upon himself for our good. And of course, as Peter says there, it's through that suffering that we can be healed, by whose stripes you were healed, which again, we'll see in a moment, comes from Isaiah 53. So there's quite a few references in this little passage to Isaiah 53. It'll be worth turning there in a moment. By whose stripes you were healed, the word for healed there is the standard word for physical healing. You might occasionally see some people sort of trying to say, well, that relates to being healed emotionally, or having a sort of a spiritual guilt eradicated, or something like that. But the reference to healed is a Greek word that appears 28 times in the New Testament, and every single time it refers to healing. It's a Greek word. If you were writing it in English, it's a rather awkward word to pronounce. Try again. Iaomai. And if you're writing it down, if you're taking notes, it would be I-A-O-M for mother, A-I. I-A-O-M-A-I. Iaomai. And it just means physical healing. You'll find it scattered throughout the New Testament. And so therefore, that's one of the many scriptures that just tells us that Jesus gave his body to be scourged, whipped, bruised, wounded for our physical healing. Moving on to verse 25. For you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. thinking the King James Version overseer would read bishop. You know, Jesus Christ is both shepherd and bishop. The word bishop is an untranslated Greek word. It means one who watches over. It comes from the Greek episkopos, and you get Episcopalian and words like that. But Jesus is the shepherd of you and me, and he's the overseer. He watches over us. It's part of his duties. And we've returned. Notice it says in 25, you were like sheep going astray. But now you've come back to Jesus, who watches over us and is our shepherd. And therefore, in a sense, Peter would be implying that if people are accusing you, if people are condemning you, if people are being very unfair towards you, and sometimes you just start to get a bit disgruntled about the lack of fairness in this world, I'm doing my best and I'm helping these people and I'm serving and I'm all the rest of it, and all I get is criticism and condemnation. My boss is a hard taskmaster. It's not good enough. I'm not happy at all. He says, remember, Jesus is your shepherd and he's watching over you. So therefore, you know, you're not on your own, says Peter. There's a bigger picture here. You have an overseer who is watching the situation, who is watching how you respond, and of course Jesus is keeping a very full record, a very full record of what's taking place in your life, and ultimately Jesus will make sure it all gets put right. Now notice in verse 22, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth. Verse 24, by whose stripes you were healed. And verse 25, you were like sheep going astray. Those are three references we'll find if we turn back to Isaiah 53, book of Isaiah, or if you prefer, Isaiah. Verse 53. And we'll pick up the story around about verse 4. And it seems clear that when Peter was writing his letter, he had this passage very much in his mind, because it does say so much about what Jesus has done for us, what he is doing for us. And of course, if we read this through, we can see that Jesus did suffer a great deal from, unfortunately, from human beings. Verse 4, Isaiah 53, surely, or certainly, he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, which is an appalling translation, really. Young's literal says, surely our sicknesses he has borne, and our pains he has carried them. And that is a far more accurate translation. Carrying on, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted, but he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities, the chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. Now, if you think about it for a moment, what was fair about that? You know, why should Jesus be stricken for you and me? Why should he be wounded for our transgressions? Why should he be bruised for our iniquities? Why should he be chastised for our peace of mind? You know, why should he be wounded and striped for our healing? Doesn't seem entirely fair, does it? He lived a perfect life, a giving life, a holy life, and yet he had to take all those things upon himself. Now, we know he was a sacrifice for us, and thank God he was, but in terms of fairness, you know, Jesus was at the wrong end of fairness and injustice, wasn't he? And in a sense, if Jesus had to tread that path, okay, there are times when you and I have to just accept that's our lot in this life and just carry on. Verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray, as Peter had just written. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Eternal has therefore, if you like, laid on him the iniquity of us all. And unfortunately, the reality is that we do very often turn everyone to his own way, even when we jolly well know better. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. And that seems to be one of the hardest lessons we ever seem to learn, is that the way that we think is going to work, if it's contrary to God's ways, it is not going to work. You know, somewhere along our lives, we have to learn the lesson that God knows best. When God says something, there's no negotiating. It's the right way to do it. And if we keep thinking we found a shortcut to happiness, a shortcut to becoming millionaires, if we're in a different way than God's figured out to be successful, we just blew it. Let's not turn each to his own way. If we turn God's way and walk God's way, well, as it says elsewhere, the path of the just is as the shining light that shines more and more unto the perfect day. Okay, moving down to verse 9. And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Again, we just saw that back in 1 Peter. So clearly Peter had this passage, I think, in mind when he was talking about Jesus there and the unfairness. Okay, back to 1 Peter. I forgot to tell you to put your $50 bill there, but hopefully by now you've gotten to that good habit. And moving on now to chapter 3. So Peter has just been speaking to the servants, if you like, and perhaps we could apply that to employees today, irrespective of what sort of employee you might be. Try and put up with, you know, people that aren't too kind towards you. Follow the good example that Jesus has set. Then verse 1 of chapter 3, likewise you wives. Uh-oh. Well, straight away it tells us that everything that's been said about servants, employees, now is to be followed by wives. Likewise, you wives. In other words, be as submissive as an employee is to be. Don't react against your husbands as employees are told not to react against their bosses. If a servant has to take sometimes criticism which is unfair because you've got a harsh boss, well, okay, sometimes wives, you may find the same scenario. So broadly, the principles that were explained about servants are applicable now, he says, to wives. And in a moment also we'll say to husbands. So likewise, you wives, be submissive or be subject to your own husbands. Now, of course, if you've been around the church any length of time, we've all heard and received a number of messages about wives and husbands, how we should live happily together ever after. And of course, by and large, it doesn't make a lot of difference most of the time, because unfortunately, we seem to hear these things very commonly. If you're a man, you think, that's it, Mr. Minister, you sock it to the wives. You tell them to be submissive to me and so on and so forth. And you get to the one about the husbands, all the wives perk up their ears and think, that's it, Mr. Minister, you tell my husband how to get his act together and so on. And so we're all busy paying attention to the other party rather than to ourselves. Then, of course, unfortunately, over the years, I think I've seen many times people taking these things really not in the spirit in which they were intended, and have been very, in a sense, mechanical in the way they've tried to apply these things. Men seeking to domineer over their wives on the basis that, come on, woman, you better be submissive to me. When I tell you what to do, you just shout, how high, sir? And likewise, of course, the women sometimes are doing their bit. So, in a sense, the whole approach that Peter's expressing here is one of individuals, be it servants or wives or husbands or indeed anybody, being cooperative, being helpful, not somebody that always fights back and argues. That's the whole point he's making, is let's be tolerant, let's be cooperative, let's work together and so on. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, not converted, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear or deep respect. So Peter's saying, look, some of you ladies, your husbands may not be converted because it says there that they don't obey the word. So here are, you know, the husbands that have not been called or have been called but haven't responded. And it says, ladies, essentially, don't try and nag them to death. Don't try and talk them into being converted. It says, without a word, okay, may be won by the conduct of their wives when they, husbands, observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. And Peter's making the point that if you're a cooperative, a lady in the home, if your life is lived in a very pleasing manner, if you are cooperative with your husband and what he's looking for, then he may well be so persuaded by the very good person you are, the good things you do, your example, that he'll be rather curious about what makes you so different. Whereas, if you think you're going to nag him into being converted, you know, why aren't you saved? You know, why do you live this way? Why are you smoking so much? Why are you working, etc., etc., etc.? That after a while, the guy's, get out of here, I can't take this any longer. She's a nag, 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 I'm off. And that's not the idea. Peter says, just like servants should be submissive to their masters, even the tricky ones, so ladies, you should be submissive to your husbands, even the tricky ones. And don't try and nag them out of it. If your life is lived in a good manner, they'll be quite impressed. Verse 3, do not let your beauty or adornment be that outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. So he says, ladies, be careful about where you, in a sense, where your priorities are. Don't try and convert this husband of yours and impress him just with your external adornment. I believe in the days when Peter wrote that it was very common fashion of the ladies to have their hair sort of like, it would take hours and hours to be sort of braided and piled in very sort of complex knots with gold and jewels and all different colored material in and out of it, and it would take them like for 5-6 hours to have their hair done up. And Peter's saying, well, okay, it's certainly right and proper that you look good, that your hair be, you know, well turned out and so on, and certainly that you're well dressed and look good and pleasing to your husband, but don't, if you like, put all your money on trying to dazzle the guy with your good looks. First of all, you know, your good looks, quite honestly, will one day fade somewhat. You may be a stunner at 22 or 25, but when you're sort of, a bit older, perhaps some of the sheen may have worn off a wee bit. So he says, don't let your attempt to impress your husband be purely related to your looks, because the thing that's going to make a big difference, verse 4, is what you can't see, the hidden person of the heart. It's your mind, it's your attitude, it's your conduct, it's your disposition that really is going to make the big difference to him. And what is very precious in God's sight is a gentle and quiet spirit, not a argumentative, bickering, battle axe type argumentative spirit. To keep our $50 bill there for a moment and turn to Proverbs 21. Proverbs 21. And verse 9. We read here, it is better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. You know, a nagging woman is not pleasant. Most men would rather scurry into a cave with a bear than have to still live in a house with a woman that nag, nag, nags all the time, walks in the door, nag, 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 goes to bed at night, and you're lying there in bed and the wife's nag, 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 and it's just not going to work. Some women think it does, but most men could say that really nagging isn't going to achieve a great deal. And Solomon said here, look, you're better off up in a corner of the roof somewhere, perhaps with a crow for company, and for some battle axe female telling you how to conduct your life. If we turn to verse 19, same chapter, Proverbs 21, verse 19, it is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. You know, get off in the middle of, you know, Utah somewhere, go out in the salt flats, better be out there with a cactus for company than a contentious and angry woman. Nag, 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 nag. You see, it's not going to work. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 15. Verse 15, chapter 27, Proverbs, a continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. You know, that drip drip, 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 drip. Just gets on your nerves so much that you're going to scream. And a contentious woman, he says, are just like drip, drip, drip. And obviously, some was not very impressed. Moving back to 1 Peter. So what Peter's saying is that, you know, the thing that really impresses God and which will really impress a man in God's eyes is that a woman who is of a quiet and gentle spirit. Not a nagger, not contentious, not always wanting to fight. You just look at her the wrong way and that's it, and the battle gloves are on and she's away. That's not quite what Peter has in mind. And he's talking about obviously trying to, if you like, you know, bring the man to understand, bring the man to God in a sense, not with words, not with nagging, not with contention, not with huffs either. You know, I'm not going to speak to him. No breakfast, no dinner, no tea, not going to vacuum. I won't even speak to him. You know, I'll convince him to come to God. Well, no, 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 no. What Peter says is that a good attitude and a good spirit is what will make the difference. And of course, you know, being submissive doesn't mean to be like a chattel with no opinions and no ideas. I think most men would like a woman that offers her opinion and offers her views and makes it very plain what her views are. And then a man should be willing to listen to that and ponder it and accept quite often that his wife is right. And I've done that hopefully many, many times, that I want to know my wife's opinions. If she disagrees totally, completely, or partially, make it known. Don't let me wander on and make, you know, things that are obvious mistakes just because I'm being pig-headed. A wife's place is to offer her views. She's got her own insight, her own understanding, her own experience, her own background. A woman who is a helpmeet unto a man can offer very strong views and make it absolutely plain why she thinks something is right, wrong, indifferent, or whatever. And then the man's job is to exercise a bit of wisdom and not try and just defend himself or his opinion because I'm the man around here. You know, I'm the one who's in charge. God made me the boss, blah, 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 blah. Okay, if you're the boss, listen to good advice. Think it through. And then if you're wrong as a man, be big enough to admit, got that one wrong, sorry, you were right. And next time I'll pay more attention to your views. Then, of course, once the man's made his decision, it's not the lady's place to then oppose it. She can make her views known every stage right up to decision moment, but then it says be submissive. So once the man's made his decision, ladies, better just get behind him. And he'd get egg in his face later, well, he should listen to you, shouldn't he? Verse 5. For in this manner, you know, being quiet and submissive and cooperative and working with their husbands, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror, not intimidated perhaps by your husbands. If the ladies believe that God's on their side, then they have a shepherd and an overseer of their souls who is watching out for them, who is watching how they behave, who is watching how hubby behaves. And, you know, God can work all things out if we trust in him. Moving on to verse 7, likewise, you husbands. Likewise what? Well, just as the servants were to be submissive to their masters, just as the wives submissive to their husbands, likewise, you husbands. Implied, be submissive to your wives. Be cooperative. Support. Work with. Don't retaliate. Don't try and get your own back. That was the advice of the servants. If you're being treated badly, Mr. Servant, don't try and avenge yourself against your employer. Go with it. Accept that sometimes things are unfair in life, but Jesus went ahead of us. He was treated unfairly. Wives, you'll be treated unfairly by husbands, and husbands, amazingly, you'll occasionally be treated unfairly by your wives. But don't seek to get vengeance. Don't get bitter and twisted. Verse 7, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. You're a vessel yourself, of course, but the men are perhaps a stronger vessel. The wife is the weaker vessel. And as being heirs together, one translation says, joint heirs of the grace of life. that your prayers may not be hindered. So gentlemen, who are husbands, you know, recognize that your wife is in some ways a weaker vessel. Recognize that, understand that, therefore be very tolerant of that. Submit, if you like, to her weakness. Don't always seek to demand your own way. It's not your place in life to be up there, top of the mountain, domineering. If she's weaker, that means sometimes you'll have to accept, recognize, and be at the receiving end of that weakness. Recognizing also that you're heirs together of God's eternal future, husband and wife together. So that, it says, your prayers are not hindered. So I guess any husband that finds his prayers aren't quite doing what he wants, maybe he needs to look at his relationship with his wife somewhat to find out whether or not all is well there. Because perhaps his prayers may be hindered if he's not showing that submissive attitude to his wife that he should show. Verse 8, finally all of you, servants, wives, husbands, children, whatever, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. So really he's wrapping it all up, Peter, and saying that all of you should really be submissive to each other. Your whole attitude should be one not of seeking to demand justice, to always get back and demand that you be treated fairly, and if I'm not treated fairly, I'm going to throw my toys out the pram. That's not what Peter's talking about. We all, in this life, in this world, sometimes get treated unjustly, unfairly. Let's not fight and battle always against other people. You know, none of us is perfect, as far as I'm aware. Every single one of us has human weakness. Sometimes we get tired. Sometimes we get concerned over various things in our lives. Sometimes we're carrying heavy burdens. And sometimes we treat each other imperfectly. It happens in families. They say you always hurt the one you love. Sometimes in families and marriages, with kids and adults and so on, sometimes in church situations, we don't always have the courtesy and the respect that we should have. And we get a little bit agitated, and we shouldn't. Peter's saying, look, let's be tolerant. Let's, verse 9, not return evil for evil. People will sometimes, even church people, treat you badly. What do you do then? Oh, well, that's it. I'm going to treat them twice as bad. Well, that's human nature, but it's not God's way. Jesus didn't say, oh, I'm going to get them back all right now. He said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And so if we're treated badly by people that we should hope would recognize our true merits, treat us better, okay, that's just one of those things in life. Just smile quietly and get on and live your best. Perhaps they'll waken up one day and realize that, you know, they did treat you badly and may even apologize for it, perhaps. Verse 10. For he who would love life and see good days, well, that must be you and me, surely. If you want a good long life and good days, prosperous days, and so on and so forth, and I think we all do, and this next three verses, by the way, is quoted almost verbatim from Psalms 34. We shan't turn there, but you may see in your margin, depending on your Bible, that verses 10, 11, and 12 here are all quoted from Psalms 34, verses 12 through 16. So Peter is doing what we do. He's quoting the Bible, quoting from Psalms. Verse 10, he who would love life and see good days, and wouldn't we all, let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. In other words, you don't respond carnally. You don't start bad-mouthing people that have been, you know, rather rude to you. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. And you don't usually create peace by arguing with somebody. For the eyes of the Eternal are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. but the face of the Eternal is against those who do evil. Now, the context of all of this is people treating you badly, bit of persecution and so on and so forth. So it's in the context of that that Peter quotes this psalm, and he means that, you know, when you are being treated as a servant, as a wife, as a husband, in a way that's not perfect, when you're suffering the ill effects of human nature, well, don't react to it carnally. Seek peace. Seek to do your best. Don't retaliate, because in God's eyes, that will make you a righteous person. You're behaving righteously, and God's eyes and ears are open. But if you start to react, start to bitch, complain, and seek ways to get back against these people, I'll teach them a lesson they will never forget. Well, God just shut his eyes to you and his ears. He just put his fingers in his ears, because his face is against those who do evil, in the sense here of retaliating. So be careful, you know. None of us like to be at the receiving end of a human nature, but it's better to be there and be criticized for doing right than to join in with them and start doing wrong and then lose God's support. Verse 13. And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? Well, unfortunately, in this life, quite a few. But it says, verse 14, but even if you should suffer, and occasionally it will happen, I'm sure, even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. It says, and do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. That's a quotation from the book of Isaiah. And really, if we really had faith in God and understood that he is our overseer and our shepherd, he is involved in our lives, he is watching. If somebody does want to treat you badly because of you doing good, then God's aware of it. So don't be too upset. It says, don't be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. In other words, just rely on God to see you through it. Verse 15, but sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear. Because sometimes if people are treating you badly when you're doing good, eventually they'll think, what makes this person different? You know, what is it that, I can't understand this. Most people would be up in arms now and fighting back, but they seem quite calm and accepting it. And it's rather a good example they're giving. I wonder what the reason is. And if they ask you for the reason for the hope, there's a confident expectation that's in you, well, be prepared to tell them. With meekness and fear, meaning in a respectful, courteous manner. Don't suddenly drop a bomb on them. You know, once the Germans come, they're going to take you out there and shoot you, and you'll get your comeuppance then, mate. Oh, right, fine, thank you for that. But there's better reasons as to why I'm living the way I'm living. You know, I have confidence in the great God, and so on and so forth. You know, there was a man in the church years ago that I knew who had that rather sort of negative attitude. That he couldn't wait for the days to come when people would be sort of lined up and bayoneted. I'll teach them a lesson for not going God's way. Well, I don't think it's quite the sort of attitude one should have had in one's mind. People that don't know God's ways and stumble around in darkness, it says, the way of the wicked is darkness. They know not at what they stumble. And so people are just like you and I. If we'd not been called, we'd be out there with them in darkness. So it's not because we're super duper self-righteous that we can say, you know, roll on the great tribulation, sort these people out. That's not really a godly attitude. You know, God takes no pleasure at the death of the wicked, and neither should you and I. Moving on to verse 16. Having a good conscience, that's us, that when they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ may be ashamed. For it is better, if it is the will of God, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. Which is obviously the case. Verse 18, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit. So in a sense, you know, Jesus is our example. As Peter's already said, Jesus was treated badly. It's an understatement. He was taken away from justice. His trial was a kangaroo court trial. It was totally illegal. He was shamefully treated, but he did not retaliate. He went, as it says elsewhere, like a lamb to the slaughter. So if you're thinking about being treated badly, having to suffer in this world against the way people accuse us and abuse us, well, Jesus had been there ahead of time. He's got the t-shirt, so to say. Made alive by the Spirit, verse 19, by which also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight souls, were saved through water. Which is a great sentence, that one. It's a bit like the Apostle Paul. I think Peter says that the Apostle Paul often wrote things difficult to understand. I think Peter just managed it there himself. That's a sort of verse, a couple of verses there that have caused all manner of consternation. It talks here about Jesus went and preached to the spirits in prison. Well, who are the spirits in prison? Some people say, well, hang on. Let's see, now Jesus died on the cross on Good Friday. That's right, yeah, yeah. And he was resurrected on Easter Sunday morning. Yeah, that's right, yeah. And of course, you know, you don't really die when you're dead, so he was obviously alive when he was dead. And of course, he descended into hell. Yes, that's where he went. So what happened was, so goes the story, what I was taught at school anyway, that when Jesus died but was still alive, if you understand me, he went down to hell, where all these souls of the departed were down there, and Jesus preached to them in that period between his death and his resurrection. Well, of course, that didn't make any sense when you realize that when Jesus was dead, he was dead, and wasn't going anywhere until the resurrection. So it clearly doesn't relate to that. So the explanation that the Church of God has always presented for these couple of verses is that it's talking about Jesus who preached to the demon spirits who are imprisoned, and his preaching took place way back in the days when the ark was being prepared. So we'll read it again in a moment. So if I give you the explanation, then we'll reread it and see if it makes sense. The story is that way back in the days when Noah was preparing to build the ark, the world was in an absolutely appalling condition. You'll recollect it says in Genesis that, talking of mankind, that every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. Now that is hard to grasp. Every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually? What sort of people are we talking about? This is like demented. This is whether it's teenagers or young kids or grandmothers and great-grandfathers. Every imagination of their heart was only evil continually. You know, day in, day out, this was an appalling period of time. What had happened to the human race that they planned, imagined, and carried out evil, whether it was cannibalism, rapes, all sorts of perversions, beyond belief, suffering and torment. And it says, again, that God repented that he had made mankind. It was so bad, so quickly, that God just said, wow, I would never really have thought that we could get this bad among the human race. Well, in that case, I'm going to destroy it. And so God sent the flood and destroyed potentially 1 or 2 billion people that were alive at that time. And only, of course, Noah and his wife, 3 sons and their wives, 8, were saved in the ark. Now, what made it so bad? What brought mankind to the point where God had to exterminate the human race because every imagination of their hearts was only evil continually? Well, the best explanation I ever had was from a minister who preached on this way back, Day of Atonement, in 1974. And his speculation, I'll be fair, but it makes sense to me, was that the demons, way back in the days before the flood, had worked flat out to pervert man so completely, so thoroughly, that God had no option but to exterminate them. The fallen angels had found some manner of means whereby they could pervert, twist, corrupt, and cause so much deviation that they virtually caused the entire destruction of the whole human race. And, of course, thankfully, Noah was one man that stood apart from that. And so God could save Noah and his immediate family, but nobody else at all. And so what took place was that back in those days, when the ark was being prepared, that Jesus went and, if you like, proclaimed to the demon spirits what was going to happen to them because of their total destructiveness and their wanton perversion of God's purpose and plan. If we turn to just 2 Peter chapter 2 for a moment, we may come back in this when we're in 2 Peter, but 2 Peter chapter 2, just reading verses 4 and 5, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell," and that is a Greek word, Tartarus, a place of restraint, "and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment." So here it talks about that the angels, in a sense, or certain of the angels, are actually now chained. They are imprisoned and awaiting a yet future judgment. It seems to be not all the angels, but certain angels have been cast down to Tartarus, which is the Greek word, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. So the whole world in those days was completely ungodly. And linked to that, it seems that God has had to imprison certain of the demons for future judgment. So if we move back now to 1 Peter chapter 3, and we reread verses 19 and 20 in the context of that explanation, to see if it sort of hangs together. So talking about Jesus, who in the Spirit went and preached to the spirits in prison, these fallen angels that are imprisoned, who formerly were disobedient, certainly were, when, this is when it took place, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is eight souls, were saved through water. And in context, remember we're talking about good people being badly treated. We're talking about servants, wives, husbands, everybody being badly treated, being receiving unjust, hostile, vindictive actions in their lives. Well, think about Noah. He was Noah, a preacher of righteousness. He was Noah, a man who was upright, a man who taught the truth, a man who was offering, if you like, safety and salvation to the people of his day. And it says here that when the long-suffering of God waited, Noah suffered persecution, hostility, just like you do, like I do. So the whole context is that Noah is another example of a man who had the whole world against him, not just an employer, not just, you know, a couple of neighbors or his family. You know, Noah, I don't know if it's a billion people. Mr. Armstrong did write once, and I've seen some numbers on it, that at least a billion people were alive at the time of the flood. But if that was the case, then Noah, for the long time he preached righteousness, had the whole world locked, stock and barrel, all billion of them, persecuting him and laughing at him and scoffing at him and ridiculing him. But he suffered that for a long time and did not retaliate. That must be in context, what we take from this. He never did stand up and say, "Serves you right, you lot, you stinkers. Hope you all drown in hell." That was hardly what was in Noah's mind, was it? Because the whole context is, don't retaliate. Don't revile. Give blessing for cursing. And no doubt Noah, you know, I'm sure he did that. Verse 21. There's also an antitype, or a like figure, I think it says in the King James Version. There's also an antitype or a like figure which now saves us, namely baptism. Baptism, in a sense, has been likened, I guess, to the floodwaters. The floodwaters washed away the filth of the old world. And, of course, through the waters of the flood came the ark, carrying people to safety. And, in a sense, Peter seems to be drawing a parallel with the waters of baptism that wash away, if you like, the filth, and out of that we're taken to safety. Verse 21, there is also an antitype or light figure which now saves us, just like the ark saved them, namely baptism, not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. So baptism, in a sense, you know, is our method whereby our old man is washed away, and we're able to move beyond that with Jesus Christ as our resurrected King and Head, bringing us to safety and watching over us. And since Jesus is there, since Jesus is above angels and authorities and powers who are all subject to him, let's trust Jesus to look after us. We haven't got to worry about getting our own back in people. It sounds so puny and so futile for you and I to divert our thinking onto, I've got a plan to get some revenge on that person. They'll regret ever treating me that way. They didn't know who they were taking on. Wait till I've sorted them out. How about just saying, Jesus, you saw that take place. You saw the story. You can judge men's hearts. Over to you. I'm going to carry on doing what's right. Because that's ideally what I think, reading 1 Peter, we should be doing. Moving on to chapter 4. Get a few verses through this, perhaps. Verse 1, therefore means that we're tying this into what we just read. And if you see what the word therefore, you have to go back and see what it's there for. We've just been reading about baptism, remember. Baptism is the means whereby our old man is washed away. It's the means whereby we come into a new life with Jesus Christ as our resurrected head. And therefore, since we've been through baptism, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. Another clear as mud couple of verses. Jesus Christ has suffered in the flesh. We know that. And we're told to, if you like, have a similar outlook. Arm yourselves with the same mind, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. What does that mean? That he should no longer live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. The lusts of men are the carnal desires of men and women, mankind really. And it says in verse 2 that you and I should not be living our lives because of, or attracted to, or according to the carnal desires of mankind. But rather, we should be living our lives according to God's will. Because it says in verse 1 that we've ceased from sin. Well, have we? Well, not technically, no. But we should have ceased from the power of sin. If we've been baptized, which is what he was on about, if we've been baptized and washed clean and come out of that baptismal tank or river or swimming pool, then we should now have ceased from the power of sin. We should have ceased, if you like, from the control of sin. We should no longer be living according to the carnal desires of mankind, but we should be living according to God's will. Now, if we hold our place there and go back to Romans chapter 6, we can see that Paul explained it pretty much the same way. Romans chapter 6, starting in verse 1. Romans 6, verse 1. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? So Paul says we've died to sin. We've ceased from sin. But, of course, not always at the practical level. Verse 3, or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore, we were buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. So when we were baptized, we were literally putting our old man to death. And in that sense, we should have ceased from sin or from its power habitually over us. And now that we've been resurrected from that baptismal tank, we should be walking in newness of life. If we turn to verse 11, of verse 10, let's pick it up there. Verse 10, Romans 6. For the death that he died to sin once for all, but the life that he lives to God. Likewise, you also reckon yourselves to be dead indeed to sin, Reckon means consider. Have this attitude that you are dead to sin, but alive to God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Therefore, verse 12, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey it in its lusts. We just read about the lust of the flesh. Now, it says don't let sin reign. It could reign. It will reign if we let it. Unfortunately, although we're dead to sin in a sense, it's still out there. It still pulls at us. And if we let it, it can still run our lives. Verse 13, and do not present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but rather present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. That's a choice that we make. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you're not under the law, but under grace. Moving back to 1 Peter, we can see, I think, again in verses 1 and 2, we just read those again quickly, thinking about what Paul wrote. It says, end of verse 1, he who suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he should no longer live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. We should reckon ourselves dead to sin. We should live in a life pleasing to God. Verse 3, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, not the will of God, when we walked in licentiousness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Of course, a lot of people think that's a great life. You just read out the perfect life there. That's what I'm looking for. In this world, if you put up a big advert, you know, over a nightclub and said, you know, tonight, come here, 8 o'clock, licentiousness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, abominable adulteries, they'd be queuing out the door. But as far as God's concerned is, well, hang on a second, you know, frankly, you lot out there, you spent enough of your time doing those sort of things. And he knew that. There were people to whom Peter wrote who had been engaged in licentiousness and lusts and had been drunks and had been engaged in revelries and orgies and drinking parties and everything else. He knew that, but he said, look, you know, okay, that was in the past. That's behind you. Verse 4, in regard to these, they, that's the world, think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. You know, crackpot, what's happened to you? You've been perverted. You don't come out drinking with us and taking drugs now and breaking into shops and so on like we used to do and have such fun together. Now you're some weirdo religious person. Verse 5, they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For this reason, the gospel was preached also to those who are dead, in purgatory perhaps, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God in the spirit. Peter seems to have chosen to have some rather hard sayings in this portion of his letter. Verse 6, I think I've come across this once, trying to prove there is such a thing as purgatory. Purgatory, in case you don't know, is if you're really, really evil, you go off to hell to sort of fry forever. If you're really, really good, nobody is, you go off to heaven. If you're the average person, you go to purgatory. And in purgatory, you stay there for the odd billion years, being roasted and toasted, purifying you of your various sins. When you've been properly purified, then you're sort of you know, catapulted up into heaven to gaze at the beatific vision for the rest of eternity. So purgatory is a place where people who are sinful but not too sinful are being scorched and purified. Verse 6, and I've heard this, there's a passage used somehow, I don't know how exactly, to try and pretend that was taking place. It says the gospel was preached to those who are dead. Well, if they're dead and you're preaching to them and they can be saved, must be in purgatory. Well, baloney. For this reason, the gospel is preached to those who are now dead. Right? Obviously, the gospel is preached to people in the 30s AD and the 40s AD and the 50s AD. And this was written around about the late 60s AD. And of course, if we think about it in today's terms, the gospel was preached to people in the 1960s, 50s, 40s, and all the rest of it. And they're all now dead. But when they were alive, of course, they heard the gospel, weren't they? The same in Peter's day. There were many, many people who had heard the good news and had responded to it. And what Peter is saying, verse 6, says, for this reason, the gospel is preached also to those who are now dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, meaning that they receive human mankind's judgment, which is the first death, but live in the future according to God in the Spirit. If you keep your place there and turn to Hebrews 9, and we'll just finish here, I think. Hebrews 9, verse 27. There is a judgment to which we're all subject. Well, perhaps the exception might be this very final generation, but by and large, there's one human judgment that we cannot escape. Hebrews 9, verse 27. And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this, the judgment. So you see, all mankind so far has died. Everybody's lived in the 2000 BC, 1000 BC, 1500 AD. It's appointed for men to die once. That's a judgment that we cannot escape, apart from possibly our final generation. So back to 1 Peter 4 and verse 6. Just reread that again. For this reason, the gospel was preached also to those who are now dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, that is, receive the first death, that's why they're now dead, but live again, shall we say, according to God in the Spirit. And of course, the resurrection will bring them to life, and they'll live then forevermore. Okay, well, I guess that will take us as far as we can go today. Next week we should quite easily, famous last words, finish chapter 4 and chapter 5, which I think is pretty good going. So on that basis, we'll conclude the Bible study now.